Welcome to The Art Informant. My name is Isabelle Humbert and I'll be your host. I have been working and breathing Islamic and Indian art history for more than a decade. How do you breathe art history, you ask? Listen to this podcast to find out. In today's episode, I welcome Fuchsia Hart, Sarihani curator for the Iranian collection at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Fuchsia is an art historian specialized in the artistic production of 19th century Iran, ruled by the Qajar dynasty between 1789 and 1925, and particularly on the reign of Fathali Shah Qajar, who reigned from 1797 till 1834. His patronage is known to us today through his numerous portraits and courtly art, but also his important architectural patronage of Shia shrines, which is the topic of Fuchsia's ongoing doctoral research. In the episode, we talk about the art, kingship and diplomacy of Fathali Shah, as well as Fuchsia's work in the V&A. As always, reproductions of artworks discussed and further links are available below the episode. Fuchsia Hart! Welcome to the Art Informant podcast. I am so happy to have you on the episode today. This is something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. So we are going to talk about mainly your ongoing research on Fathali Shah Qajar and obviously your work at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. So very excited. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah, thanks. So let's jump right in with, obviously, the first question that I ask everybody. What brought you to Islamic art history? Who or what encouraged you in this direction?
So it was a mixture of an interest in the region and an interest in the languages initially. So it really stems back to from when I was at school, and I really enjoyed language learning. And when it came to deciding what to do at university, I, you know, initially thought I might do classics, but then I also had an interest in the Middle East and the broader region, which I think really stemmed from the fact that, like actually so many of my peers, I think, who work in this field now, we grew up with obviously places like Iraq and Afghanistan being in the news for all the wrong reasons. And that really just sparked an interest. I just wanted to know more. So when I was looking into what I could do at university, and I kind of literally just discovered flicking through a brochure that you could do things like Persian and Arabic, I, as a 17-year-old, was just, you know, thought, why not? Let's just do something different. And thankfully, it wasn't a bad choice. So my undergrads was in Persian. So, you know, the language, the literature was really initially, and the history was initially what really interested me. And I actually did Persian with the ancient languages of Iran, which thankfully is not, you know, they're not something I have to use anymore because they're really difficult. But, you know, things like Avestan and Old Persian and Middle Persian. But that gave me a really, I think, a long durée kind of understanding of Iran and its history and its literatures. So then following my undergraduate degree, I actually went straight to Kabul to work for Turquoise Mountain, which is still going, a cultural heritage organization based now in many countries, but originally founded in Kabul to promote the traditional arts of Afghanistan. And that was really because I sort of had the language skills. And so then it was really there working with artists, calligraphers, ceramicists, woodworkers, jewelry makers, that I really sort of got this actual kind of like hands-on experience. And that sort of really piqued my interest more in the material culture. But actually I also, for my thesis, for my undergraduate dissertation, I wrote my thesis on a manuscript of Bal'ami's history, the sort of Persian version of Tabari's history. And I think it was that experience of, you know, I was interested in how texts were edited and how This is actually something that Noor talked about a little bit as well. I sort of had this light bulb moment that, hold on, these edited editions that we read as students, where do these come from? And so anyway, and obviously I was in Oxford and there was the wealth of the Bodleian Library there. So I'd worked with these manuscripts a bit as an undergrad, and then the experience in Kabul of working with artists made me realize that, wow, I could kind of carry on doing this. I could do this as a job. And so then I returned to study more. I knew I wanted to study more, and I did the 2-year MPhil in Islamic Arts back in Oxford, which really is, I mean, it's an incredible course. It's really in depth and it's pretty intense. And that was kind of my like crash course introduction to Islamic Arts. And then of course, yeah, I carried on to do the PhD as well. But in some ways I don't know whether I'll ever really feel like an art historian. I think I feel like a historian that uses objects as sources, rather than necessarily like a diehard art historian. But I think that's just because of how I came to the subject, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. You started with the language and the culture, and then you moved to material culture. But and I think we had a similar conversation with Noor in the previous episode. It's really interesting to see how, you know, different people arrive to Islamic art history. That's why I like to ask that question, because you have different avenues, also creating different points of view, different approach, different methodologies. And that is really what makes that field interesting and alive, really. It's just having different people with different backgrounds looking at material culture. And so we are going to talk about your doctoral research in a moment, but before that, I wanted to ask, when and how did you start your career in the Victoria and Albert Museum?
So I was really lucky back in 2017 to first get the role of research assistant for the Iran exhibition, which then became Epic Iran. So that was kind of a first year. So I took some time off the PhD to work full time at the V&A. And that was an amazing experience. I mean, it was kind of a dream come true to get to work at the V&A. And so I was supporting the, you know, curatorial aspects of the exhibition. And that was, it was amazing. I learned a lot, but as it sort of happened, as happens with many exhibitions, the exhibition got delayed. And I decided to go back to my studies to the PhD. But so I didn't sort of see that and obviously, you know, COVID happened. And so Epic Iran eventually opened in 2021, I think it was. But while I was at the V&A for that year, there were also lots of other things going on. There was the major decant project happening so some people might know that the V&A is actually still in the process of moving the vast majority of its stores. So they used to be at a site called Blythe House in West London. It's now moving to Storehouse in East London. And so when I was first there in sort of 2017, 2018, we were preparing for this, for the decant, for packing everything, and we were auditing everything. And so I got to help with the audit of all of the Iran material, which that was, I think, part of the richest experience, because I got to have this kind of hands-on insight into the really encyclopedic collections of the V&A, particularly ceramics, the tiles, which I think we'll talk about a bit more, and the textiles as well, which really do feel, they're vast and encyclopedic.
Nice. Amazing. And so that was in 2017. Then you went back to your studies and then you came back to the V&A.
Yeah, I sort of in between, I kind of stayed on at the V&A part-time doing little bits and bobs. There was a project on the 19th century in Egypt and Syria, which I did a little bit of sort of internal research on, and I also then took over as the course tutor for the Islamic arts course in the V&A Academy, the sort of learning side of the V&A, which was also really fun. And that course is still going. I don't run it anymore, but yeah, if anyone wants to learn about Islamic art, you can also come to the V&A for that. Bit of a plug. But yeah, so I kind of always, I kept in touch in a way, with the department, with the Middle East section, yeah.
Awesome. Nice. So we'll continue talking about your work, especially in the V&A, a little bit later. But in the meantime, I would like to come back to your research on 19th century Iran. And because you are currently writing your doctoral dissertation on the architectural patronage of Fath Ali Shah Qajar. So first things first, who is Fath Ali Shah Qajar? What do we know about him?
So we're lucky that we know quite a lot about him, but I'll start kind of with the basics. So Fath Ali Shah was the second ruler of the Qajar dynasty. His predecessor was his uncle, Agha Muhammad Shah, who is the founder of the dynasty. I think, though, their reigns are, they're sort of markedly different. They've been characterized in very different ways. So, oh, I should say that Fath Ali Shah reigned from 1797 to 1834. So we're really looking at the first few decades of the 19th century. So Agha Muhammad Shah's reign is really characterized by military conquest and expansion, or I mean, really reunification. So what he was able to do was to reunify the disintegrated lands of Safavid Iran. So obviously the Safavids fell in the 1720s with the Afghan conquests, and then those lands that are pretty much what Iran is today, they disintegrated, they were fragmented, lots of local dynasties. You know, there was still a Safavid heir to the throne, but there were lots of kind of competing local dynasties, most notably the Afsharids up in the northeast and the Zands down in Shiraz, are the ones that most people know about. But Agha Muhammad Shah was able to reconquer all of these lands. And when he died, he had actually been castrated when he was a prisoner of the Zands. Yeah, which is why he's always kind of depicted as like beardless and kind of withered. And so Fath Ali Shah was actually his nephew. So that's why Fath Ali Shah was named as his successor. And he came to the throne 1797. He was crowned slightly later, I think 1798. So Fath Ali Shah inherited these reunified lands. He did, in the first few years of his reign, there was still some military conquest. There were descendants of the Afsharids still that he spent quite a long time actually trying to quieten them down. But the way that, you know, Fath Ali Shah's reign is now recognized, and I would support this, is that he then had a task of dynasty building and empire building. And all these things that we know about him, that he's often sort of, well, in the past he's been ridiculed for, his long beard, his love of lavish spending and sort of, you know, decadence, and his portraits, which obviously we'll talk about, and having loads of children, which he really did. You know, it's true, when he died he had something like 150 living children, and of course many more, you know, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But all of this was not just, you know, because he was an Oriental despot, as he was sort of, you know, shaped at the time, but this is because he was very, in a very calculated and measured way, he was building a dynasty to rule over a country, and he was building the apparatus of an imperial court that would match it would try to match the splendor of the Safavids, but it would also compete with his peers at the time as well, so the other empires with which he was in contact, so mainly the British. And he was in contact with the British through both sort of from London and the Crown, let's say, and also from India, from the East India Company. And then, of course, the French and the Russians. So we know a lot about him. And we know this because, I mean, obviously, it's relatively recent. Although in some ways that doesn't mean we don't have gaps in the sources. The Qajar, let's say, record keeping is not known for, well, unfortunately, a lot of these records don't exist, basically. Even though Fath Ali Shah himself did set up a pretty successful bureaucracy on the Safavid model, a lot of these things don't survive for various reasons. But we have lots of texts, internal texts, so courtly histories and literature, poetry. We have his own poetry, although, you know, all of this obviously we have to take with a pinch of salt and remember that these are official texts kind of sanctioned by the ruler, which are giving one very specific view. But that's interesting for us, right, as historians. This is the view, this is how he wanted to be viewed. And then we have the material culture side of things, obviously the courtly art, the portraits. So we have quite a good idea of how he looked. But of course, we also have the external sources. So it was during Fath Ali Shah's reign that diplomatic contact, let's say, between Iran and Europe really took off. It took off after a hiatus. Of course, there was contact between Europe and Iran during the Safavid period, but during Fath Ali Shah's reign, it rose to a height that it had never been at before. So we have a plethora of European sources, British sources, both kind of travel logs, things like that, but as well the East India Company archives, let's say, well, the India Office records as they now are. A whole mixture of sources that obviously those European sources have their biases as well, but you know, that's our job to try to make sense of them and create some kind of holistic picture from all of these things.
Yeah, exactly. But that's such a rich material. The relationship between Iran and Europe, as you mentioned at that time, are unprecedentedly high and complex and dense. So you can really form a kind of maybe objective picture of what was going on between those European sources and obviously the Persian sources. And so what are the most notable art pieces produced under Fath Ali Shah patronage?
Well, I think undoubtedly the most iconic and well-known pieces are his portraits created in oil paints on canvas. And these are huge. I mean, some of them are sort of bigger than life size almost. They're really imposing works of courtly art. And obviously these are well known now. In the 90s, of course, there was Royal Persian Painting, the exhibition, the Brooklyn Museum. I think that really sort of increased the knowledge about these paintings and also encouraged people to start taking them seriously, I think. I mean, of course, from the 19th century, Qajar art has the problem that when our field was formed, it was current. You know, that was like contemporary art. And of course, it wasn't taken seriously. It was seen as being of lesser quality than Safavid art. You know, we all know how this material was viewed. But I think, yeah, it's in the past kind of 30 years that the courtly art of Fath Ali Shah's reign has started to be taken seriously. And I think we've really seen that with the portraits. So excitingly, something that we know about them is that he definitely had a say in how he was being produced. And I think that's something that's really notable about him, and that I would say we see through all of his artistic and literary patronage, that he is very personally, is very consciously building an image of himself, which is one of perso-Islamic, perso-Shi'i legitimacy in the Safavid mold. I mean, you know, it's something that was built up over a number of centuries. And of course, there's Turkic influences in there. He is building an image of himself with all of that rich history of kingship and religious kingship, let's say, in Iran. But I am going off the topic now. but I wanted to emphasize that he is very active in producing this image of himself. And that's, I think, what makes these portraits notable and exciting, because something that maybe I should explain briefly is that the Qajars don't have a quick ticket to legitimacy. Initially, you know, they have legitimacy in as much as they have military might, right? They were able to conquer everybody else. And this is not a new problem. The Safavids had this, were in this situation as well. And they had the, obviously, the spiritual, the religious legitimacy stemming from Sheikh Safi. But they, you know, they had to up that, and they had to give themselves this imami lineage. So it really fell to Fateh Ali Shah to create this aura of legitimacy and to create a viable ruling dynasty that would be legitimate and ultimately successful. So that is why these pieces of art are notable, because they're all playing into that wider goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that leads me directly to the next question, which is about his contribution to Persian architecture. What is his contribution, and why is it kind of significant?
That's an area which has been less studied.
Yes, and this is where you come in.
Yeah, so my research just focuses on his patronage of shrines, but I will sort of start by saying that he patronized architecture far more broadly than that. And I can direct readers towards Marcus Ritter's Mosquen und Madrasa Bauten in Iran, which looks at patronage of mosque and madrasa architecture in Iran in the early 19th century. But on top of mosques and madrasas, there's also palaces. So right at the beginning of his reign, Fateh Ali Shah builds Qasr-e Qajar, which then is sort of the main palace in Tehran. And it doesn't really exist in its original form anymore. It eventually became a prison, and now it's a prison museum, the Qasr prison museum. So he was building palaces. I mean, he built a number of palaces to the north of Tehran as well. He obviously made additions to the Golestan Palace, which is the most well-known palace in Tehran now, really. So he, you know, he's expressing his royal right to rule and that royal persona through the building palaces. He also immediately builds mosques, most notably the mosque which is now sort of in the south of Tehran, known as the Masjid-e Shah, and a number of other regional mosques. And of course, he also uses his sons, so I mentioned all the children earlier, but his sons are all acting as local governors for him. So he basically is sending them out into the provinces so that he can aim to have control over this, you know, these the new lands that they've conquered. And of course, they also are architectural patrons as well. So it's kind of important to emphasize that. And also his daughters as well, and other members of the court are also patronizing architecture. But my doctoral research has focused on his patronage of the major shrines, both in Iran and Iraq. So that's largely the shrines of imams. So in the case of the imams, there's obviously Imam Reza in Mashhad, and then the imams buried in the Atabat in Iraq, so in places like Karbala, Najaf, Samarra, Qazimain. But then in Iran, also actually most significantly for Fateh Ali Shah, is the shrine of Fatima Masumeh, who is the sister of Imam Reza. So she's not actually an imam, but, you know, very close, and it's the second most important shrine in Iran.
Why is it more significant for him?
So that's actually a good question. The shrine in of Fatima Masumeh in Qom is the shrine that he patronizes the most. And he basically, when he comes to the throne, or the sources kind of vary on this, but just before he comes to the throne, or when he comes to the throne, he basically says that if, you know, I come to the throne and I'm crowned as I should be, if all goes well, he basically makes a nazr, which is a sort of vow. He says that I will give 100,000 toman for the, you know, restoration and embellishment of the shrine in Qom. And I think this is for a number of reasons. At this stage, it was interesting, his reign also coincided with the rise in power, let's say, and importance of the Shi'i clergy in Iran. So a lot of the clergy had left Iran after the fall of the Safavids. They went to Iraq, but they, in very simple terms, some of them started coming back. Qom was starting to become a center of Shi'i learning and teaching. And obviously Fath Ali Shah, he needed the legitimization from the clergy, from the religious establishment. I mean, whether they're rising in power or not, obviously he needed that support. And I think it's not really necessarily something that this isn't the argument I'm making, but it's clear that he personally was very pious. I think we can, especially if you compare him with Nader Shah, who had a very complicated relationship with religion, I think we can tell that Fath Ali Shah really was he's kind of a textbook Imami Shi'i. I think that aspect does play into it, but I'm more interested in how he used these shrines as kind of backdrops for, as stages for his royal patronage and an expression of his legitimacy, because really it's only the ruler that can patronize these shrines in certain ways historically. We also have to remember that Qom is actually very near to Tehran. So the difference between his patronage of Imam Reza in Mashhad and Fatima Masumeh is quite different because of the different political situations. So Mashhad is, and it's really always been like this, it's a border place really, and it's a place that's always been slightly unstable, and it's always been raided from the east by the Uzbeks or the Afghans and at the beginning of his reign, Fath Ali Shah, as I mentioned, was dealing with the Afsharid sort of pretenders, and so he fought a number of campaigns in Khorasan to regain Mashhad, but he had problems all throughout his reign with the Turkmen raiders, and so his patronage there was slightly more patchy, and obviously he couldn't go there as often. It's much further from Tehran. Whereas Qom, he went there pretty much on a year. He seems to have made a yearly trip, but he would also stop by. Like if you're going south to Isfahan or Shiraz, that's on your way. It's on the main road. So it was much closer to him physically. And that goes the same, it's the same for the shrine of Shah Abdulazim in Ray, which he also patronized, but not as heavily. It's more of a minor shrine. Yes, that's why, in a nutshell, Qom was important to him.
Why did he pick Tehran as a capital city? Because obviously for Safavid, it was Khazvin, then was Isfahan. I think the Afsharids was Shiraz, or was it the Zand?
So they're more Mashhad. It's the Zand.
No, they're Mashhad and the Zand were Shiraz. Yeah. So why did he decide to set up in Tehran?
That came more from his uncle, from Aga Muhammad Shah. There were historic palaces there. There was, the Golestan was Safavid palace there and had been developed after that as well. I think it's because it was closer to their traditional heartlands in the north of Iran. Their tribe, the Qajars, are from the north of Iran, sort of from both sides, and they've moved around a lot. And I have to say, this is not something that I've really...
this is a bit of a random question, but it just...
No, it's okay. But yes, basically just it's closer to their heartlands and their forces, basically.
Okay. I always wondered that because obviously Tehran is quite far from the sea, well, the coast, any borders, like kind of like the weather, like the climate is nicer if you go to North Tehran. And
he moved around a lot though. Year he went out of Tehran for the summer, basically.
Of course.
So there's still that slightly... nomadic is a complicated word, but there is still this sense of the court moving at times.
Of course, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously there is a part of legitimacy and religious legitimacy in restoring, embellishing imami shrines, but is there any other reason why a ruler such as Fath Ali Shah would focus his resources on restoring imami shrines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've mentioned the sort of the straight religious side of it. I think there's probably two other points that I would make. The first is, one that's in a way pretty obvious, but generosity was actually a very key attribute in kingship in this time. And this is something which we see in the Safavid period, which I'll touch on again in a minute. But when we look at in these kind of courtly histories that I mentioned, of Fateh Ali Shah's reign. At the end, they kind of go through to his death, say, and then afterwards they discuss him. And they always discuss how many children he had, but then they also discuss his kind of like eight qualities that made him a good ruler. And generosity is always really quite high up there. So I think there's a lot to be said for, and as I already touched on, this kind of idea that he's just frivolously spending all this cash and that he emptied the coffers and the treasury of Iran, but the spending was very targeted, and it was spending which was expected of a legitimate ruler in that shape. But so also, so the second point linked to that is the Safavid precedent. So it's now really recognized that what Fateh Ali Shah did to build what really was an empire. He was really trying to shape himself as an imperial ruler. And he largely drew on the Safavid model to do that, which isn't surprising. And I think, I mean, we shouldn't also forget, I think quite often we do jump straight back to the Safavids, but we shouldn't also forget that the smaller the dynasties that were in the intervening period, the Afsharids and the Zands, they also carried on a lot of this. And we have to remember that Nader Shah also patronized shrines, albeit with his complicated religious stance. And he also had paintings, oil on canvas portraits painted of himself. So, yes, that's just a bit of a caveat. Obviously, Fateh Ali Shah is responding to the rulers that went straight before him, but he is really adopting a mode of rulership which was kind of canonized by the Safavids, which, yes, he didn't go as far as to, he couldn't claim this imami lineage, but he did use the mode of rule which the Safavids used, and he adopted he adapted it for his own times. And this is something I have to mention, that a really good book has just come out recently by Asif Ashraf on this very topic. It's Making and Remaking Empire in Qajar, Iran. And so he's really discussing the kind of the statecraft that went into this. But I think I see exactly the same thing happening with the material culture, that as a good and proper Perso Shi'i ruler, Fateh Ali Shah had to patronize these shrines, because that's exactly what all the Safavid rulers had done before him. It's obviously what the Timurid rulers had done, it's what the Mongol rulers had done. He was inserting himself into a long line of great rulers who patronized these shrines. And there were, for example, in a lot of these shrines, he patronized the zari, which is the kind of metal, now metal sort of lattice work structure, which is right over the cenotaph. So he produced new silver zaris for a lot of these shrines. And that really, the patronage of that most sort of intensely sacred part of the shrine is really just the preserve of the ruler, in these big shrines. So it is also an expression of his position that he can make these interventions in these most important of sites in his lands.
Nice. So obviously for the audience, I will put the bibliographic references and also some pictures under the episodes for you to check out. And so from like a really from a material culture point of view, what are the characteristic of his architectural patronage? How do you recognize a Fath Ali Shah restored architecture?
Well, that follows on quite nicely, because I think we can definitely call it a kind of neo-Safavid style. So on the very, the very instant thing you will see is the continuation of the same style of tiles that are used in the Safavid period, both in terms of the technology, the Haftrangi, the so-called kind of Quercus style, square tiles with then this very distinctive kind of blues and yellows, but also pinks obviously coming in the Qajar period. So I'd say that's the kind of initial visual you're going to get on these sites. And also in terms of architectural, the structures, very similar. We're still seeing minarets in a very Safavid style that kind of changes under Nasiruddin Shah. So I'd say in terms of style of the buildings in it themselves, we can look to the Safavid precedent. But then there are some innovations as well. So he gives to shrines a lot of precious objects in precious metals, so lamps and doors and the zaris that I mentioned. And something I'd say that links all of these is the use of enamel on precious metal, and also inlaid jewels. So obviously Fateh Ali Shah inherited, well, once he'd conquered the Afsharids, he got the loot which Nader Shah had carried off from Delhi. So Fateh Ali Shah had a huge array of diamonds and rubies and emeralds and pearls also at his disposal. So we see a lot of precious metal objects, let's say gold lamps, which are enameled in, again, a very distinctive Qajar palette of sort of maybe a white ground with pink flowers, dark green ground, dark blue ground, and inlaid with diamonds and rubies. But something I also want to add, which is something that I find really fascinating and would like to continue working on, is the presence of inscriptions. Now, because I think when we think of, classically, when you're learning about Islamic art and architecture, you always think about in these religious contexts, within the mosque, within the madrasa, you're going to have Quran and Hadith, basically. And we do see that, but we also see a big rise in kind of let's say, not secular, but in poetry, basically, in newly composed poetry. And this is also because, and something I think that isn't sort of recognized enough, is how Fateh Ali Shah's literary patronage went hand in hand with his artistic patronage, because he was responsible as well for a real renaissance, known as the sort of Bazgasht in Persian, a renaissance in literary production at his court. And he surrounded himself with poets and writers and as I say, court historians, which again is in the Safavid mold. But and he particularly, his one of his most notable courtiers was Fateh Ali Khan Sabah, who was his Malik al-Shu'ara, so he's like the poet laureate basically. And Sabah wrote a lot of poems about and for the courtly art. So we have a lot of poems from Sabah praising objects made at Fateh Ali Shah's court, and then his poems are also inscribed onto the objects, or indeed onto the buildings. And it's the kind of stuff you'd expect. It's him praising the imam, or and then him praising Fateh Ali Shah and him describing the object. And so the presence of inscriptions is also really key, and we see that across the media. So we see that on the paintings as well, when the paintings are sent to diplomats abroad, or the East India Company or whatnot, they have inscriptions on them. There's heavy text and literary element as well, which I think is really key.
Yeah. And so you mentioned earlier that Fateh Ali Shah wrote poetry himself. So did you find any of his poetry on buildings, on objects? Did he kind of plugged in his own work on like buildings?
So there's only one example of that which I've come across, and that is, it's quite remarkable actually that you're asking me this. So, and that's on his own tombstone, which is a really remarkable piece from his reign, which we also know that he had a hand in designing it, and saying he sort of prepared his own tomb for himself. And
Where
his
is
tomb is
it?
actually, so it's in the shrine of Fatima Masume in Qom. And so we know towards the end of his life, because he was in his 60s when he died, so he knew, he was getting pretty old, his health was failing, he had lost his two oldest sons, he'd lost Abbas Mirza, his heir, and he realized that he didn't have long left. So he started to prepare his own tomb, and he had his own tombstone carved. And his tombstone is completely remarkable because it's completely innovative. It has his portrait on it in a sort of reflection of how we're used to seeing him in the oil on canvas examples, but carved into stone, which is often referred to as marble. I don't think it's actually marble, but I think it might be a type of onyx. But so he's standing on it, although you know it was flat on top of his cenotaph. He's standing and he's surrounded by angels, and there's a number of poetic inscriptions and prose inscriptions on the tombstone, including signatures. There's a few signatures of sort of the designer and the carver and the calligrapher, and so yeah, it's a real treat for the art historian. But there's also there's a couple of poems there, and actually in other inscriptions in his tomb, which have been attributed to him. They are in his divan. These particular verses do have his pen name in them, which is Xaqan, which is, of course, a kind of a Turkic title for a ruler.
If you're enjoying this episode, please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite audio platform and give a rating. Add a comment and share on social media to help grow the audience and the community. To support the initiative, buy the host a coffee via the link under the episode. And now, back to the interview.
Moving on slightly and changing slightly the topic, I would like to talk about the Victoria and Albert collection and your work in the collection. So you have worked also on the Shah's English ceramics. Can you tell us about examples of his services which you hold in the V&A?
Yeah, this is another project I'm working on. So in the V&A, we have five examples, five pieces from two services which Fath Ali Shah owned, made for him by Wedgwood, of course, in Stoke-on-Trent here in England. And it's really the story behind these that interested me in them, because it's a really interesting example of diplomatic gifting in this period. So this instance of diplomatic gifting is quite interesting because so we know that Fath Ali Shah sent an ambassador to England in 1810, Mirza Abul Hasan Khan, and he was accompanied by James Maurier, who's kind of famous for writing Haji Baba, which I don't necessarily recommend reading, but he's important in this story. So James Maurier was secretary to the British envoy in Iran at the time, who was Harford Jones. And so Mirza Abul Hasan Khan and James Maurier, when they were in London, they went to Wedgwood and placed this order for these services for Fath Ali Shah to be gifted to him by the East India Company. And I was really helped by colleagues in Wedgwood, because the Wedgwood archive is now part of the V&A. So it's actually the Wedgwood Museum is now an outpost of the V&A. So my colleagues in the archive really helped me, and we found the original paperwork relating to the order and how Harford Jones in Tehran had actually shown Fath Ali Shah some examples of Wedgwood services, and he chose these two specific services. The blue peony, which we hold three pieces from, and then Japan service, which we have two pieces from. So again, you know, I'm interested in this because I think it really shows Fath Ali Shah personally taking these decisions and really shaping the material culture of his court, which we see through these Wedgwood services, which of course are totally, I mean, you know, this is the height of European fashion at the time. The blue peony service had actually just been chosen by the Prince Regent here for his service. So, you know, Fath Ali Shah is participating in very global tastes at this time. And there's a further kind of level to it, which of course is that both of these services are chinoiserie, Japoniserie, you know. So I think it really gives us an insight into the kind of 19th century eclecticism of his court as well, which is not just, you know, yes, there was the gold and the enamel that I mentioned, but there's also English ceramics, there's Chinese ceramics, and all sorts of, you know, other bits, gifts from Russia. And, you know, it was much more diverse than I think we might imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. While you were talking, I remember that actually Sotheby's in April is presenting some British ceramics for Qajar rulers. It's a set of six plates for Nasiruddin Shah. Fajar and not Fafanja.
Oh, okay,
Same.
interesting. Yeah, I'll have a look.
Yeah, and for the audience, if you are in London, obviously go to the V&A, first and foremost, but also there are actually two sets of ceramics made for Nasreddin Shah, one English and one, I think, Chinese. So yeah.
Interesting. Exactly. So this really continues under Nasruddin Shah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And yeah, Fath Ali Shah on these services, he had his Mirza Abul Hasan Khan here. He did the calligraphy for Fath Ali Shah's name and his titles to go on these pieces on the service. So that's how we know that they're definitely from, they've got Fath Ali
Oh.
Shah's name on them, basically.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. So
Yeah.
that was really a collaborative work to
Exactly.
produce those ceramics. Obviously, Fath Ali Shah picked the design, but then there were additional work done on those ceramics and on those plates, and they were produced for that specific occasion.
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting. Wow, fascinating. So I assume there was obviously a catalogue of motifs that was available.
Exactly.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And they're gorgeous. I mean, totally like me being subjective here, they're gilded and they're beautiful.
And do we know how they were used, those services? Because obviously they're heavily gilded, they're very precious, they're very fragile. Do we know if it was for just display or if they were used in banquets? Or, yeah, what is the context here at this end?
I think it's hard to say for sure, but there are signs that they have been used. But something I think what I'd add here that's also quite exciting and adds to this collaborative aspect is that so, and this is something I'm not an expert in, but at the time in the early 19th century in England or the European context, obviously there was a very set formula to how a dinner service, how many pieces it would be comprised of and the shapes. But for this, for Fath Ali Shah's services, totally new shapes were made. So Maurier also brought a list and drawings of how a Persian dinner set, I should say, a Qajar dinner set would, what shapes they would use, which were a lot of sort of deep bowls to hold stews and rice, and they would sit on a plate. So these were actually made, I mean, they were made to be used. They were made to fit the dining habits of Fath Ali Shah's court. But this is something I definitely want to, I think that's an avenue that I need to research more. But unfortunately, as I kind of touched on earlier, all the courtly sources don't really, it's not the kind of information we get necessarily. But maybe the European sources might help me a bit more on this.
Yeah, it's a very complex topic, but this is very interesting. And that reminds me of an episode that we did with Valentina Brucolieri, who worked on Chinese ceramics. So, really different topic, and obviously earlier as well than the 19th century. But she was saying something similar about the shape of the vessels that were, it was Chinese ceramics, but adapted for the Middle Eastern market. With shapes that were not used in China, they were specifically for the usage of a Middle Eastern table. So here we have a similar example where the ceramics were made in England, but to be used in an Iranian context with different shapes and different usage. So that's just very interesting. And so those ceramics made for Fath Ali Shah are now exhibited in the V&A. So you worked on the case, the exhibit case. So can you tell us a little bit more about the process of displaying those dishes, those plates, and about also what the overarching theme of that case? Obviously, it's a Fath Ali Shah exhibition case, but what is in it, what we can see, and what can we learn by looking at those objects?
Well, I have to say, this is still a work in progress. So it's not actually on display yet. So,
Oh, sorry.
but no, I mean, I hope it's still interesting. I mean, I hope it will, it is a work in progress, but I hope it should happen. But I can talk a little bit, I can give you an insight into this is then sort of more maybe my things I do on a daily basis at work. So yeah, I'm currently in the process of developing a redisplay of one of our cases which focused on the Qajars. I mean, I have to say, I'm not kind of doing a whole redesign of it because the so this is an existing display. It focuses on Fateh Shah's reign, and through the objects, they the thing the objects sort of have in common is it does tell a story of diplomatic gifting. So in there at the moment, there is actually a portrait of Mirza Abul Hasan Khan and a dagger which was given to John Malcolm, who was one of the first envoys at Fateh Ali Shah's court, and also an incredible solid gold dish, enameled, of course, that was given to the East India Company by Fateh Ali Shah. But so yeah, to sort of give you an insight into why we do these redisplays, the portrait of Mirza Abul Hasan Khan is a work on paper, so it's light sensitive. And it's been in there for a while, so we needed to take that out. And we also, some people might remember, for a long time, we had on loan from the Khalili collection, we had the insignia of the Order of the Lion and Sun, which was given by Fateh Ali Shah to Kinnear, another British envoy at his court. But that has now gone back to the Khalili collection. So we wanted to make some changes in the case. And I, because I had been researching these Wedgwood services, I was really keen to add one of these pieces into the display to sort of show, I think we'd shown the gifting from Iran to this country or to the East India Company, but we hadn't shown the other side of the story, which is that, the diplomatic gifting went both ways. And of course, yes, again, to emphasize that the art and materiality of Fateh Ali Shah's court was more diverse than perhaps we've shown before. So really the story of the case isn't going to change, but we were adding in the one of the dishes from the Wedgwood service. And also at the same time, above the case, we have a portrait, one of the large scale oil on canvas portraits of Fateh Ali Shah. And excitingly, we also, just before I came into my current role, actually, so it wasn't my acquisition, but the museum acquired a new portrait of Fateh Ali Shah. So at the same time, we're going to take the existing portrait down and we're going to put that portrait up, the new one, because it's just been conserved and it looks beautiful and clean. So, yeah, as I say, this is all a work in progress, but we hope that yeah, we'll have these two pieces on display soon.
Amazing. That's exciting. And so, yeah, you, so the, this new portrait of Fateh Ali Shah was acquired in 2022. So before, again, you moved into your current position, but do you know, are you able to tell us anything about the acquisition process? And I'm particularly curious on the choice of acquiring this piece, knowing that you already had a portrait of Fateh Ali Shah.
So yeah, this was quite a specific acquisition because it was actually acquired as acceptance in lieu. So it was assigned to the V&A, and largely because it sort of had a bit of a connection to the V&A because it came from the collection of Basil Robinson, who was a curator at the V&A, and he acquired it in London in the 50s. And I think again the research on that is still a work in progress, but it's different to the existing portrait that we have, which is he's standing in this portrait, he's seated resting against a bolster, which is it's quite a common mode in which he's depicted. And this portrait is actually signed by Meher Ali, who was one of the sort of the most prominent court artists in the early years of Fateh Ali Shah's reign. So it's probably an earlier example than the other painting that we have. And there's also a poetic inscription on this painting as well. And so we can expect that it would have been a diplomatic gift to, somebody in Britain, but that's something that, again, yeah, it needs more research. But no, we'll be glad to be able to get it on display.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so, is there anything that you would like to exhibit in the future on Fateh Ali Shah?
Oh, on Fatali Shah.
Or maybe not only on Fathali Shah, actually, on like, because obviously the Iranian collection is so large.
Well, I'll also mention another recent exciting acquisition, which also actually was not exactly my acquisition. My predecessor, as you know, has happened just before I came into the role, but I sort of finished it off. And it's an amazing group of 48 prints, works on paper by modern and contemporary artists from Iran. And they were donated to the museum by a couple of artists in Iran, Tarlan Rafi'i and Yashar Samimi Mohfakham. And it's an amazing collection with some really fantastic, you know, some big names, Parviz Tanavoli, who I'm really glad we now have in the collection because we didn't have anything by him. And then maybe some artists that are slightly, you know, lesser known in this country. So I hope at some stage that we'll be able to display some of those as well. But yeah, it's you know, it's hard. There's so much we want to get on display, and we only have limited space. But in the V&A, in the Jamil Gallery, we're lucky that we have one case which we rotate regularly, so we can use that for temporary displays. And actually, that was something that I recently worked on. So at the moment, it's a display that I curated on something totally different, which is dress and embroidery from Afghanistan from the Hazara people.
Oh, nice.
So that's also on display in the Jamil Gallery at the moment, and that will be on until next year.
Good. And with that, hardest question for last. What is your favorite piece of art produced during the reign of Fatali Shah Qajar?
Yeah, this is it is almost impossible. But I fear I'm going to be a bit boring because we have actually already talked about it. I think for me, it has to be his tombstone, because for me, it's the work that really helps me to understand him and his goals during his reign. Because, you know, this is the work of art which was created right at the end of his life. It's his legacy. You know, it's how he wants to be seen. So I think for me, you know, purely for the kind of historical interest in it, it's got to be the tombstone.
Amazing. Great. And with that, Fuchsia, thank you so much for coming on the episode of the Art Informant today. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you and learning a lot more about Fatali Shah Qajar. So thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Art Informant. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on your favorite audio platform, add a rating, and share around you to grow the community. Do not forget to follow The Art Informant on Instagram to receive all the podcast updates, and I will see you in the next episode.